Good morning. Can everyone in the back hear me all right? Am I yelling at you in the front? Sorry. So as a state senator is driving home late one night, he realized that he forgot to pick up a book for his wife that she'd needed for the next day for an event. Having already passed closed bookstores, he spied an open public library. Now, he was nervous entering the library because he had gained some fame in proposing library budget cuts, and once had called for an outright elimination of public libraries. However, he was quickly put at ease when the library director greeted him warmly, asked how she could help and be of assistance. The senator told her the name of the book he needed, and the director looked up the call number, ushered him to the book, checked him out, and sent him on his way to his wife with a smile. Afterwards, a librarian approached the director and said, "Do you know who that was?" And the director said, "Yes." "Why would you be so nice and help him?" The director said, "I didn't help him." The librarian said, "What do you mean? You found the book, you checked it out, you sent him on the way." "If I had helped him, I would have mentioned the lipstick on his collar." So, just like to gauge my audience before we get started. I know where we're going. So thank you very much for having me. It's been a couple years, and I really appreciate the time to talk to people in the trenches and see what's going on. And I'd like to start out with a few things that I believe, and we'll sort of move in from there and talk about why I think this is the year, and from now on should always be the year, of the librarian. And I want to talk about the notion of being of the people. So we'll explain that in a little bit more detail. So I believe that the best days of librarianship are ahead of us. I know, and it can be hard to say that. And it can be really hard to say that, right? But what's amazing, a year ago we would have talked about how people are falling out of our libraries and they're overstuffed and we can't get enough and we don't have enough resources. And now, of course, this is the sort of famous parable about how the farmer goes and gets the milk from the cow, cuts the cow's feet in half, goes, gets the same amount of milk, is thrilled, cuts it in half, goes the third day and finds the cow's dead. So I know where we are. And I know that this is sort of dark times. But I really honestly believe that the best days of librarianship are ahead of us. I believe that we're the right profession, uniquely positioned to lead in a knowledge age. However, it's always a but, right? We won't get there following current trends and with our current focus on recorded knowledge and buildings, or as someone once put it very elegantly, our edifice complex. So we need to sort of look for and begin to define a new librarianship. What does it mean to be a librarian in the age of electronics, of falling budgets? Hopefully someday those budgets will come back. How do we survive in this world of massive change? How do we survive in a world of Google and Amazon and all of these things? I believe that we need to define a new librarianship that is ultimately focused on knowledge and conversation, that's dedicated to social action and innovation, and is dedicated for being a service not for the people, but of the people. Now, that's, you know, I come from a university. You get used to university people talking these grand sweeps and all that other stuff. And yes, the Ivy Tower must be nice, Dave. How's the oxygen up there? But let me talk a little bit and make that sort of reality about a focus on information, things, and buildings versus a focus on knowledge and people and conversations. True. And I want to do that with a series of thought experiments. So we're going to bring out three experiments I want you to think about. All right? And yes, those are squared answers on the end. No good presentation without a squared answer in it. That's what I'm saying. So thought experiment number one, we will call it the iPad, Kindle, iBook thing. And here's how it goes. What if in the next 10 or 20 years, every time you bought the device of your choice, they charged you an extra $10 or $20 for the price. But that $10 or $20 was accumulated into a massive national fund that was distributed proportionally back to the authors and owners of intellectual property for the materials you get. The net effect being that you can get any book, anytime, anywhere, and not have to call it piracy. That electronically we have readers that can handle multimedia content, that can handle color, and that you can just imagine putting things on and off, all the digitized material going on, all the new materials, all the new books, right there on the iPads. All right? What would librarianship and libraries look like in that environment? And I bring this experiment up because it really does force you to take a stand on the notion of collections. Because one way to look at that environment, that if we had a free or cheap ebook reader, could get any book we want on it, one could say, therefore, we don't need libraries. Right? We've made them obsolete. And others would look at that and say, that would be fantastic. We need librarians more than ever. Because can you imagine someone walking in and saying, gee, I'm doing a research topic on X, I'm looking for a job about Y, I'm thinking about starting a business on Q, I have to do this assignment, and being able to just literally hand them all the resources they need in full text back on their device or loan out a device. All right? Now, you may say, oh, gee, Dave, get real. Come on, we can all live in la-la land, but that's not how life works. But I would ask you to take a look around for a minute on how what librarianship has done. Because we have seen a massive shift in the past 30 years in library collections. We have moved from an ownership model to a rental model. Look at the most used resources in public libraries, in academic libraries, in school libraries, and librarians and libraries don't own them. We rent them, we lease them, we license them. We get our databases that way. Increasingly, as we move to expanded use of digital music, digital files, digital movies, digital books, we don't buy them, right? Everyone remembers that wonderful, not ironic at all moment when Kindle retook Animal Farm off of people's Kindles. I mean, you know, to pick a George Orwell book to take back because you thought you bought it. One analogy said it would be like Walmart breaking into your house to take that bookshelf back late at night, right? But what happened is people thought they bought the book. It's my book. And Kindle said, well, actually, when you did that little click agree, you said, I don't have any ownership rights. I have the right to use this, and I give you all these other rights. And so as we move to an environment, iTunes Music, when you buy iTunes Music, while they really tell you that you're buying it, you're not. When you look at streaming service, when we look at the new setups for books and materials, your databases. I mean, I have students that demand a collection development class. I want collection development. I say, great. We want the economics and law department to teach it because it's not about, oh, did I get the right collection and the right mix? It's how much are they going to screw me over for these databases this year, right? Sorry, I get excited about these things. We have an explosion in artifact production. And that is the idea that I think maybe Thomas Jefferson was the last one who could sort of make a convincing argument that he had all the good books. Right? Since then, I mean, I love how the fact that the publishing industry is in great distress, but clearly they hate books so much that even if they go broke, they're going to kill trees to make them. Right? I mean, they hate forests. The idea is that we're printing up more and more and more and more and more titles. It's not like you're wandering around in collection development going, boy, I wish there was something I could buy with this money. Right? We have too many things. And not only do we have too many things, but increasingly they're being broken apart. So in an academic context, the idea of interlibrary loan for journals, no one does interlibrary loan for a journal. They do it for an article. They do it for a piece. They look online and find it. This whole notion of what is a journal in academic life is blown apart. And increasingly, we're seeing content happen in fiction, in nonfiction, all these kinds of materials. We're taking what once was a nice sort of unit around it, being broken up into parts so it can be resold or relicensed 20, 30 different times. An explosion in data. So one of the reasons I worked with the PennDOT folks on a National Academy panel once, and we were looking at the notion of how we could ease information sharing in the transportation industry. We all sat around the table, and we all looked very earnest, and we all said, yes, we should share information. That's good. We do that. And they started talking about what they're sharing. Well, we should share our reports. Yes, we should share our reports. That's good. We should share books. Yes, books like that. And then we realized that what they were talking about was this itty-bitty little drop in the bucket. Oh, we'll put it in WorldCat. That will solve all our problems. Thank you, OCFC. But then we realized, do you know how much transportation information we're talking about and the books and all that? The group got together and we sort of did a back-of-the-napkin estimation. And we realized that within about 5 years, every mile of highway in this country is going to produce about a gigabyte of data per day, which will soon become a gigabyte of data per hour. Black boxes, traffic toll information, environmental impact study, road conditions, salting, the environmental impact study, all these things are data that accumulates. If you generate a gigabyte of data per mile of highway in this country per hour. You now start talking about generating exabytes of data per year. Just in case you're wondering what an exabyte is, an exabyte is enough memory to store every word ever spoken by mankind. One, right? And we're talking about five times that in things like, how's your asphalt feeling? So, now you look around and you start to say, exactly where do I shelve 5 terabytes of asphalt data in my collection? But this is happening everywhere. We're talking about massive amounts of being generated. I mean, do you remember the days when you took a camera on vacation so you could come back with that, like, 24 good pictures? Right? Oh, I don't know. It's pretty cute, but I don't know. I might have to buy another roll of film. Right? Now we sit at the breakfast table. I'm sure there's a good picture of cereal in here somewhere. We're just bursting. Remember when we had 5 megabyte hard drives and we thought, wow! And now we're sitting there going, if only I could get, you know, little Jami's bar mitzvah on this hard drive because I have 3,000 pictures at 5 megapixels apiece. It's going nuts. So, in the middle of this, we have a total disintegration of traditional publishing models, which is, it's quaint to talk about things like encyclopedias, right? As if we could buy them or contain them or how do they work. Well, we know they need to be dynamic and open and constantly changing and editing. Editions? Editions by minute by minute by edit. What is an album anymore? We have albums that have disappeared into song requests and we're not able quite to put the genie back in the bottle. Did anyone, by the way, hear about the Pink Floyd lawsuit? It's a beautiful lawsuit. So the Pink Floyd sued the publishers of their music because they had in their original contract that you shall not break up the integrity of the album. I mean, Roger Waters, a real piece of work, said, I worked very hard to put those little children sounds and things throughout that entire album, and by breaking into individual songs, you're breaking the integrity of the album. So I'm not letting you sell, you know, Dark Side of the Moon anymore, you gotta sell the whole album. Right? But, wow, that's bizarre. How does that work anymore? So, what I'm trying to say is this great thing about $10 and we all get free videos and free music and free whatever we want, may not be as much fiction, and the same issues that we talk about in that great future cast are here today. Look around your libraries. Look past what's sitting on the shelves that you may well own. I use the word may. And look at what's being used on a regular basis by volume and understand that it's not yours. That you have become brokers and not aggregators. So, let's move on to our second thought experiment. And this one comes from one of my personal favorite human beings in the world, Eli Nyberger. He's the technology director at the Ann Arbor District Library. Does a lot in gaming. We're sitting talking one day, and he said, I had a member come up to me and have a great idea. He said, I can go in the catalog, and I can find out what you have to loan in your different facilities, your branches. Yes. He said, I got a bunch of books at home, and I'm willing to share them. Can we catalog my books at home, and so someone can come into the catalog, request a piece of material, I can pull it off the shelf and bring it in the next day as a hold? Yeah, oh God, someone just, oh God. So, but copy cataloging for Danielle Steele is easy. So, but how you think about that thought experiment, how you think about that service, tells you something, right? Uneasy, you can say, oh, I do it, I don't do it, oh, that makes sense. All right. But if it strikes you as odd, going, well, wait, that's not the library's collection, that's the individual's collection, right? If it strikes you as odd, saying, well, why? We have this collection, you have your collection, we're separate. But at the same time, that's how public libraries started. I got a bunch of stuff, you got a bunch of stuff, we got a room, let's put on a show. It's sort of Judy Garland-esque all over again. So think about, you know, when we think about this term, is it a library that's for the people, meaning it's our stuff that we provide to the people, the state or the county or the city buys it, we provide it to the citizenry, we are for the people, we are service, or is it a service of the people, in which case it makes a lot of sense that their resources, their collections, their expertise are part of that collection, part of that service. And we can't leave without talking about square dancing. So Meg Back is one of my just favorite ever students. I have another favorite ever student. I've got to be careful. She introduced herself here. She graduated, and she's working in a library, and she had a great idea. She's the adult services director. And this this woman's brilliantly crazy. Like, she had a dog and she started loaning it out. And she barcoded the dog. She called it a bark code. Isn't that brilliant? I mean, it got to the point where she had a community gardening project where they were gonna, and she barcoded the plots of land so you could borrow a tomato. I just thought, you know, you don't want to do the returns on a tomato. But finally the central library called and said, stop it. You can't barcode these things. And she's like, yes, I can. Watch me. And so at one point she decides what would be really cool. And she says, I want to have a square dancing event. I thought that was fun. And she's looked around her library and says, I can't do it here. There's not enough room. I mean, you know, do-si-do, twirl, bang, crash. Not good. But it turns out that she's on land, sort of a developer, an undeveloped 30 acres of land where apparently people are in jail and can't actually develop it and such. But they have built a library, they built an ice rink, which is sort of a community center. She goes, I'll do it there. She said it was very fun. You know, people showed up and were square dancing and all these hockey people were walking by going. So that she comes back to the library and some librarians sort of pull her aside and go, what was that? She goes, it was square dancing. I know you may not have seen it. She goes, no. He said, no. Why did you do that? She goes, it was a library service. He said, no, it wasn't. Because it wasn't, you can fill in the blank, in the library. So do you define that event as a library service because the library put it together, the library sponsored it? Does it only count if it's in the library? Right? Now, the reason I bring up these thought experiments is that there are ways to think about the notion of collection. There are ways to think about the notion of community, and there are ways of thinking about the notion of facility. Right? These thought experiments ask you to take a stand. If you come down one or the other, you take a stand. You have an approach. You have a viewpoint. A lot of what I talk about is that librarianship has this sort of core value of unbiased. And I'm the first to say, that's not true. We have biases. That's how people exist in the world. We make decisions. If you say things like, but when someone asks us a question, we present multiple views on a topic, that in itself is a bias. There are many people that said, no, you only present the best information, whatever that is. So we have these biases. And this idea that we can somehow forget at the reference desk by the time someone's already selected the books, bought the books, coded the books under a given category, put it on the shelf, but when it comes to reference, we go, no, unbiased. You have the book, right? How does gun control part of your collection? Right? Do you have sex education as part of your collection? You make determinations, you make biases, you make it all the time. We are not unbiased. We are intellectually honest. And those are very different things. Intellectually honest is saying, this may not fit what you're looking. You may have to understand that this is my approach. You may have a different one. And we're principled in that we expose it. But that's not the same thing as saying that we are neutral. Neutral comes from the same root of the word neuter. And I don't think that's what we want to broadcast to the world. So how do we make these decisions? How do we decide if that was a library program, if we should include those bedroom books, if we'd like the idea of this sort of joint fund for it? And my answer comes around the mission. What is the mission of your library, and what is the mission of librarians? Now, missions are tricky things. So I want to show you a mission, and I want to then tear it apart, and as always is the custom, always pick on the home crowd. The State Library of Pennsylvania provides information for state government and citizens while collecting and preserving our written heritage through materials published for, by, and about Pennsylvanians. Now, I look at that, and you go, okay. I look at that, and I see a few questions. First of all, the State Library of Pennsylvania. Where is the State Library of Pennsylvania? Well, is it this or that? Does the library do anything? I want to be real clear here. I hate when people say the library does things. Because either you're talking about an org chart or a building. And all a building can do is decay, fall down, and cost money. Right? People do things. The librarians of the state library, the employees of the state library, the people, the citizens, this is an obligation that we have. By simply creating this sort of royal we, the library, we abdicate our personal responsibilities in that action. And we provide information. No reason why, we simply do. Right? No goal there, just, hi, how's it going? Want a pamphlet? Thanks for coming. Right? It's we could be the perfume people in the store. Want a book? Thanks. Right? Why are we providing that information? For state government, for citizens, while collecting, preserving our written heritage, because if it's said, it doesn't count, through materials published by, for, and about Pennsylvania. Right? What this mission sounds good, but when you begin to break into it, it begs the question of why. Does this mission help us answer those questions? And I think it doesn't. So I want to give you my mission that I'd like to put forward. The mission of librarians, you, is to improve society. You're welcome to stop there. I think that's ultimately our mission. Through facilitating knowledge creation in our communities. Now, a couple things to note. The first thing is this is about librarians, not about libraries. This is people's individual tasks that make this happen. This is why when you walk in and you say, our library website sucks, if you have the word library in there, you abdicate responsibility that your website sucks. People made that. People designed it. People put it up. You may not agree, you may not whatever, but that means that there's a conversation and there's action that can be taken. All too often, I hear about things like state government does. Don't we elect them? Don't they represent us? These are people involved in this. The second part of that, through facilitating knowledge creation. We're not just about people coming in to, like, hang out. We're there for a purpose. We're there to provide a safe space. We're there to provide a learning space. By the way, this does not say replace all your books with textbooks. What this means is that we learn much from fiction and nonfiction, right? My favorite book growing up was My Name is Asher Lev, and I learned a lot about what it was like to be a kid who liked to draw. I learned a lot about myself through fiction, and I think many people have that story. What's your favorite book? And when you reflect on your favorite book, it wasn't because of the typeface, and it wasn't because it had a cool cover. It's because you learned something about yourself. Your preferences, what you want to do, what your motivations were, what your impact, what you care about. Now, this mission on its own is just words. It has to have ties to deeper meanings, because I think one of the issues that we worry about as librarians is we are so functionally focused. We are so obsessed with process that we rarely step back and ask the most important question, which is why? Why do we have collections? Why do we have buildings? Why do we do reference? Why do we catalog? Why do we have this budget for materials? Why do we have this budget? And I think oftentimes whenever we ask that why question, we're too quick to jump to the conclusion that simply asking the question assumes a negative answer. Why do we catalog assumes you don't like that. I love some people in the reference community say, oh, there's Dave Lankus. He hates the reference interview. Why do they say that? Because at some point in a large conference, I said, why do we need the reference interview? Which was followed by a lot of, because, blah, 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 blah. But because I asked the questions, assumes that I didn't believe the value. Why questions are about tests of fitness. To question something is to determine its value and its strength. If you ask why about a function and it survives the test, it is a good function. There is, by the way, a second question that you must always ask, which is why not? Right? Because all too often the why question is used as a way of stopping it. We should blog. Why? It's often like, oh, why? Right? There's also a why not question. But I need to go a little bit deeper than just the mission. Where does this mission come from? Well, we have concepts of mission. We have concepts of what do I mean by librarians? What do I mean by improved society? What do I mean by facilitation? What do I mean by knowledge creation? And what do I mean by communities? And these themselves we can then break down and bury and ground in foundational deep concepts. Because I think one of the problems we have when we go to do advocacy about what we do and why we do it is if we don't have that bigger picture, all we're left with is what we do and not why we do it. We need more money for collections. I'll give you a perfect example. I was on a public library board. They had major cuts in their budget in the 80s. Their materials were slashed. And so this board came in, and they made it a principle that every year they were going to increase the materials budget by 20%. Budget comes in, increase the budget by 20%, the materials budget 20%, which worked great in the boom times in the 90s. Then we had that little recession thing, not the Great Recession. And they still got the budget. They said, oh, all right, so we increased the materials budget by 20%, but we're going to have to lay off librarians. And I looked at them and I said, excuse me? I said, why do you want to get more stuff and less ability to make the stuff useful? I mean, why don't we get rid of all the librarians, throw a big book pile in the middle and say, go! Right? All they knew was a process. They knew material's good, add, and they never stopped to ask, why? Why is more stuff good? Right now at Syracuse University, we're having this great expression, humanities faculty want more books in the library. More books in the library. Okay. And then they say, look at the ARL statistics. We're like number 20 millionth on there, and there are people at the same size that have a lot more volumes. I said, I can handle that. Give me like $10, and I'll go buy the crappiest, cheapest books I can find. Will that make you feel better? Why? Why is it when we ask about the value of a library, we begin by declaring our collection size? I mean, I hate to make this Freudian, but... Why? Why do we do these things? I was in that same board. I was at that same board. They had reference present, and this board member goes, so let me get this straight about reference. If I'm eating dinner and I spill red wine on a white tablecloth, I can call you up. Yes. Why? And the idea is he asked, he said, and the taxpayers are paying for this. And you should have seen the reference librarians. It was, I mean, at first it was the deer in the headlight. And then it was like the deer with a shotgun. I mean, you know. And they came up to me, you know, Dave, the reference guy, and said, Dave, how dare he ask? And I said, you had no answer for that. I said, if you don't have an answer for that, why are you answering that question? If the answer is because, one, all citizens' questions we take equally, that's an answer. If it's because it's the lost leader, you know, if they ask us that, then they'll ask us important stuff about jobs. I said, that's an answer. But simply because we've always done it is not an answer. As they say, the first thing you do when you find yourself in a hole is to stop digging. Just because we've always done it doesn't mean we should always do it. I mean, let's face it, if Ranganathan wrote his laws back in Greek times, he would have said, all scrolls are for use. Do you think he would have said, oh, not books? No, those are different, just scrolls. Right? The idea is that technologies change, capabilities change, but the mission should be durable and remain. So let's break this down into some deeper concepts. So when I talk about knowledge creation, and you'll notice in the first or second slide I use recorded knowledge in quotes, I hate that phrase. Let's all take a moment to hate the phrase recorded knowledge. It means the same thing as intelligent rock. It means, but you can't record knowledge. It sits in your brain. The minute you record it, it becomes something called an artifact. We'll get that in a second. But think about a rock. If you take a rock and you hand it to a geologist, they can tell you what kind of rock it is, probably where it came from, just about how old it is. You hand that rock to me, I'll look at it and say, yes, that's a rock. Now, did the rock have the information about its age and duration, or did the geologist bring it to that material? When you're reading a book, what are you doing? Are you having a conversation with the book? If so, it's probably a pretty boring conversation. I mean, take a test. Pick out your favorite book, look at the book, go, how was your day today? And see what it says. Right? The idea, you're not having it with the author. You pick up Hamlet, you go, Bill, what were you thinking about? Bill's not like waking up in Stratford going, well, where I was going with this was, right? It doesn't do that. You're having a conversation with yourself. So knowledge creation ultimately comes from the idea that knowledge is created through conversations. Those conversations can be one-on-one, group to group. They can be individuals. Now, as people who work in public libraries, you get a little uncomfortable when you hear about people talking to themselves, but we do that on a regular basis. If at some point during my remarks you said, what the hell is he talking about? Who were you talking to? Right? We talk to ourselves all the time. Right? Does this thing make me look fat? Yes, it does. Do I care? No, I'm fat. Right? These kinds of conversations happen. This comes out of something called conversation theory by a fellow who was chemically enhanced called Gordon Pask in the 70s, and he wanted to teach machines how to think. And he said, well, until machines catch up, I'll deal with how people think. And so he looked at how people learn, and he found they learn through these conversations. And a conversation consists, and don't worry, even in the front, they can't read what that says. They said it comes from a conversant. Who's doing the back and forth? Are they two people? Are they parts of the individual? Are they two groups? Libraries talking. Library states talking, etc. It comes from the language that's exchanged back and forth. Yeah, I had a great quote yesterday. Sue Colieri at Syracuse said this brilliant thing. She was at a military briefing, and she said, I think we are about to render the field of encryption useless with the number of acronyms that we use. I mean, if I say something like, yes, our OPAC uses MARC and has a Z3950 module, realize that only you know what I'm talking about. Right? It's like I have Italian relatives that barely speak English, and I know what they're talking about. I just can't tell what it is about me that they're laughing at. So we have these conversants, they're exchanging language, and why? Because they're seeking to come up with an agreement. They're seeking to agree what it is. Now, it's not facts. Agreements can be, well, isn't it a nice day today? Well, yes, it is. Or, oh, it's cold today. It can also be, how high is Mount Everest? How high can my plane go? And it's really important to realize is that those agreements only matter in context, which is how high is Mount Everest when I'm trying to fly over my plane that will only go this high? Context matters, right? And lastly, we have a memory. We remember these agreements over time. So when you're engaged, for example, in a licensing negotiation with your catalog vendor or those wonderful people who sell us those databases, what you're doing is you're exchanging language, sometimes very formal legalese, in which you're seeking agreements, all right, you will do this, you will screw me over for this, etc. And we then encode that into something called a contract. But that contract only represents the conversation. It is, in fact, not the conversation. I'm sure none of you have ever been in a situation where they've needled out of the spirit of a contract by the language of the conversation. Never happened, right? The idea is that the artifacts produced from a conversation are not the conversation. They are not the knowledge. They represent it. They can help foster other conversations, but it's not the conversation itself. But we can take this now and say, all right, we have these agreements. People working on an agreement. Agreements can lead to artifacts like these contracts. Okay. But what that means is that we need to invest in tools of creation over the collection of artifacts. If our job is about knowledge creation, if what we're doing is improving our community by building knowledge, and that is a creation process, we need to stop worrying about archiving the old conversations and start worrying about creating the new conversations. So that's why when we take things like iPads and Kindles and we wonder, does that collection matter? The answer is, maybe not. Because really, you can have a room full of books and it's called a closet. You have an empty room with a librarian in it and you call it a library. Because it's the function and the skill we bring to it that makes it a library, not the fact that there's dead and rotting trees next to it. By the way, I love books. Don't get me wrong. Just, they're tools. Right? Now, we can follow this out. So we'll move that up here. We'll take another look at artifacts for a moment. And we can talk about the death of documents. What does that mean? How many people would like to give me the accurate MARC record for Google? If anyone could please take a moment to catalog Facebook. This idea, apparently the projector did not agree.
We'll take a moment.
Hello.
Oh, yes, thank you.
I've been rejected by my projector. Let's see if that comes on, if not. So what it means is the idea of a document, take a look at an e-book. Is an e-book an electronic book? No. It's a metaphor. Book becomes metaphor. It's book-like. It's document-like. But it's not the same thing. Just like when Gutenberg decided that he could do this thing called a printing press, the very first things he was producing were illuminated manuscript-like things. And it took years and years for people to realize that maybe we could give them a title. And maybe we should use these things called page numbers. And maybe we could get rid of some of the drawings or have other illustrations. And it took hundreds of years to evolve into what we know as a book. And the same thing is going to happen with e-books. The notion that they have pages and they have sequence and that they're basically one long line of text that gets wrapped every so often and bounded to some interface is not make them uniquely book-like. So we're seeing this disintegration all the time. You know, you're seeing Wikipedia never ends. I mean, you guys have trouble enough dealing with additions and serials. Wait till we have sort of momentarily edits and deletes around the whole text, day by day, minute by minute. So how do we deal with this? Well, ultimately what it means is if we don't have document-like things, we have to look at the relationships of things. Right now, a lot of what we do, I see a light, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. A lot of what we do is based on the round of things, artifacts, right? So we get a book, we catalog a book, we shelve a book. Where does the book fit? It fits in Dewey this way. But the idea that I want you to think about is the fabulous, more like this Holy Grail, right? When you go into the catalog, you find that perfect book and you say, I want more like this. How do it know? If you read Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, you say, I want more like this. What does that mean? More youth fiction? More stuff by J.K. Rowling? More stuff about guys with lightning scars on their head? What is it? The answer for me is it's the complete book of Legos and the Star Wars complete encyclopedia of vehicles. Why? Because when my 5-year-old and I were learning to read together, all right, technically he was learning to read, I was learning patience, those were the books that we bonded over. That's a relationship that you will find nowhere in that book. And yet for me, it's how I'm going to find the next thing. How can we find materials together? So look at your catalogs. Think about how much time you deal with the item when the truth is the value between them. Look at the, you pull out the Gutenberg Bible. Someone looks at the Gutenberg Bible and they say, that's the origin of printing. That's the meaning of that book. It should be under the printing heading. Someone looks at that and says, no, 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 that's a valuable artifact. That needs to be preserved. That's got money in it. Some people look at that, that's the word of God. Those are three radically different contexts. By the way, not all mutually exclusive, but three different relationships for the same artifact. And when we catalog them and force them into one thing, we get rid of all that richness. All right? So, we need to look at how we change our integrated library system. Now, that was timing. Now, when we ask the question about are we for of the people, think about this, which is, all right, if that's knowledge, you said that we facilitate knowledge creation. What does it mean to facilitate knowledge creation? Well, firstly, we provide access to conversations. Remember, knowledge equals conversations. So access means those conversations, or at least materials that can enrich conversations. All right? Now, classically, that has meant that we bring stuff that is not the community to the community. When you look in your public library, does it look and feel like your community, or does it look and feel like your community, what your community is learning about elsewhere? How many people come to your public library to learn about what's happening in your community? My guess is, on your websites, they may be. There's author and speaker series. But I want you to think about, access is not providing only one way. There's your member, there's your patron, we provide access to this really glorious rich out there. It's two ways. I'm having a conversation. I'm your member. Get me people. So when we talk about blogging in public libraries, I think we need to stop worrying about you guys blogging. Not that you're not interesting. Not that I don't want to hear about what's happening with your cats. Not that I don't want to hear about this. But what if we supported blogging for our members? What if we hosted those things? My wife started a mom's club in Syracuse. It started off with like 13 people hanging out and talking about how they could exchange information and data. It grew to 300 people very quickly. And they started doing things like, I've got an extra stroller, I need to borrow a bed, someone's coming in. Hey, I hear the flu's coming out, where can I get the shot? And they went to the public library for some of the events, but where was the public library to say, that's growing too big, you need to create virtual communication. We can create a system, listservs and emails and blogs for you. Instead, they went to Yahoo Groups to do it. Now, Yahoo Groups is fine, but where were you guys? Maybe you're there, I'm just saying. Now, besides providing access to the conversations, we need to provide baseline knowledge to the conversations, which is great that I can find a job by searching monster.com. What's .com? How do I get it? And what's that funny-looking thing with a wire coming out of it? Basic computer literacy would be helpful, right? It's one thing to say, I can get there, but I don't have the reading ability to get there. I don't have the language ability to get there. I need baseline knowledge. So instruction becomes intimately intertwined with what it is to be a librarian. The notion of an environment, a safe environment. In public libraries, that can be just as simple as, I'm not going to get beat up after school. That's an important, safe environment. You can't learn if you're always under fire. I mean, let's face it. As librarians, we don't live in a very safe budgetary environment right now. We're not spending a lot of time on new initiatives, right? Because we're worried, rightly so. But safe environment can also be an intellectual environment. When I'm surfing information, no one's going to be watching behind my shoulder. Also, you mentioned the idea of participating amongst ourselves. How many people here have been on a committee that has existed for over 50 years? No one goes to ALA? Tell me you don't have an executive committee that you're on. Come on, right? Yeah, a couple of you. How many people feel that unless they were there for the entire 50 years, you didn't know what was going on, right? How many of you know the historian that's on your staff that's undeclared? They're the ones in the meeting when you bring up a new idea. They're like, well, what you've got to remember, and it always starts with that. What you've got to remember is that we tried extended service hours in 1922, but people couldn't get their horseless carriages parked in time. So, you know, that's the reason I bring that up is not saying, boy, that's a great example of a memory. That's a great way of creating a very unsafe environment to learn, right? The idea that we shut people down. It's the same thing that we teach in reference, that when people come up to the reference desk, which, by the way, in itself is a lovely little artifact of when we had chain shelves. When people come up to the reference desk, which is always this high and we're on stools, you know, and we say, and they say, I'd like a book. And you're like, oh, which one? You know, it's like the grand face of Oz. A book, 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 book. So, is that a welcoming environment? I was talking to someone who was on executive staff at a central library, and they were talking about budgetary cuts, and all the branch people said, you people don't know what it's like. Come here and work here, and you'll know. And so they actually did. And the person I was talking with was, you know, I sat at the sort of desk, and I was doing the returns. And when anyone would walk in the door, I go, hello, how's it going? Have a nice day. And she says, she's doing this, all the library staff's like looking at her. Like leprosy has just been brought in. You know, or she was checking out books. She's, oh, you'll love this book. This is a great book. Oh, I saw this movie. It's like, oh my God, you talk to them. Right? Is that such a bad thing? And I love this idea. Well, but Dave, it's all about privacy. We have to preserve the privacy. Give me a break. How many people on a reference desk don't say, oh God, it's him again? Right? I know a little bit about virtual reference. I go online, it says, please fill in your name, please, David Lankins. And I get back, it's like, hi, Dave! It's like, please don't cut, please don't cite me your talk. No, you know. I have no privacy. This is a relationship that we're building, and no matter how much we pretend that it's not, what it's doing is it's creating a boundary between us and them. The last thing we need to worry about is what is their motivation? Why are they here? And I hate to break it to you, but we need to get past the idea that it's only people having revelatory moments in the library, that it's all about the kid who learns to read. That there are reasons that people are there for, you know, political reasons. There are people that are there for non-political reasons. There are people that aren't there because of political reasons. Eli Nyberger, once again, talking about a gaming program. He said, you know, 13-year-old boys were coming in the library, and the first week they're all like, don't tell anyone I'm here. You know? And so, or I guess, don't text anyone that I'm here. And so they came in and they started playing these tournaments, and they started keeping track of the tournaments and who's the best. And now they had 13-year-old boys dragging people to the library website to say who they pwned last week and who's at the top and all those things. And they became a net detractor of social capital to a net gain of social capital for these teens. And creating that environment, understanding what motivated the teens in terms of recognition, brought better service, better community, better conversations. Now, look at access. We already provide meeting spaces. We provide meeting spaces that come in. Why not then talk about shared shelves with the community? Why not go back to that bedroom collection and why we can't share it and all those things and say, well, you know what? We can. There's still a resource question, and can we catalog it all? And I grant you that. I don't want to dismiss the realities of this. I want you to look at the philosophy of this. What if the Historical Society came in and said, we're willing to pay for you to catalog materials that are in ours, can we put it in your catalog? Here it says, but yes, that makes sense. It's consistent, right? So we're not making arbitrary decisions. We're looking at the foundations of that. Now, one last comment, which is that true facilitation, if knowledge is a conversation, conversations require two people. It also requires taking a breath from time to time in order to listen. And what that means is two people own that conversation. That means, from the patron's perspective, they can shape the conversation. It also means that as librarians, you must recognize that you shape those conversations. The language you use, the tone of voice, your physical appearance are shaping those conversations, and we need to be aware of those things. But it also means that ultimately, if we look at the notion of this community being part of us, and us as part of the community and not for. If you are for people, you're a tool and separate. To facilitate is to act upon. You have users and customers, not members. If, on the other hand, you feel, as I do, that library is part of the people, then to facilitate is to engage and help the community because it is helping yourself. You have members. If you see yourself as a tool for the people, you have a job. If you see yourself as a member of the community, you have a vocation, a calling, a mission. I had a former student who sort of in a hushed tone one day said, you know, don't tell anyone I think this, but I sort of look at myself as like a pastor, walking about the community, worried about its spiritual well-being. Except I worry about, you know, their knowledge. I worry about their information. I worry about the decisions they make. And to do that, I need to be out in the community. I need to be part of them. They need to see me as a trusted source for doing that. So we need to think about being of our communities, not for them. Now, we can go back and break these down. And in fact, if you take this mission and you've got too much time on your hands, we can break it into something called the Atlas of New Librarianship, coming soon in the March 2011 from MIT Press. You too can read through all these. But my point of this is we should all, to a degree, have one of these in our heads. It may not be quite this bizarre. But if you break things down, you get to ideas like assessment, which is how do we assess our services? Well, Dave, if you said it's not the number of volumes we have, it's not the size, it's what we do with them, then how do we assess this? Well, how about going out into the community and asking, not how can the library help you, what do you like about the library, horrible questions, right? Because first of all, you're going to get the people who love you or hate you to answer those questions. You're not going to get the grand middle. And the second is, it's an irrelevant question. How do you feel about air? I need it. That's the answer we want, right? I always hated the love of reading. I hate the love of reading. You can tell I hate many things, right? I'm an angry man. But why do I hate it? Because mathematicians don't talk about the love of math. They talk about the power of math, the necessity of math. So we put up read posters with friendly people on them. You don't see accountants putting up pictures of, like, Britney Spears loves subdivision. You know, we don't do that. I don't actually love to read. I love stories. I love learning. I love many things. I think it's actually illegal in Georgia to love things that way. But the idea here is that books and reading are means to an end. There are books that I love. I mean, there are books that I just physically love. I mean, back to, you know, good old McLuhan days when he talks of them as art objects. I'm an ex-illustrator, so I'm like a paper fetish, right? I love pens and I love those things. But what are they for? What's it for? They're tools to the end. Talk about a publisher of the community. People coming to your library to learn what's about your community, not just what your community is learning about others. The notion of leadership, which is if we're in this conversation, we have an obligation to take a leading role in that. Sometimes we need to tell the community what they need to know. Sometimes it's okay to stand up and say, this is wrong. Another Ann Arbor example. They got a great comment. What can the library provide to make your experience better? Response, more pie and prostitutes. Now, we have a bakery. That might help our state count, but is that where we want to go? Right? We have a voice to say, as a community, we get to say, no, a library is about these things. A library is about doing this. This is the role, and we have a voice in shaping that. That we can look at questions of gaming. Why does gaming fit in a library? We can talk about questions of topical centers with curriculum. We have to talk a lot about LIS education. I'd love to stand up here and say, we're doing a good job. We got a lot of changes to make. We can look at the idea of going to embedded librarians and going to conversations and not waiting for the conversations to show up at our doorstep. And ultimately, what we need to talk about is creating a new social compact. A social compact. This is the charter, I think it's from the state of Colorado. But think about it. You guys have charters. You had some negotiation that says this is the structure and in there is a statement of the value of your library. But we know that what happens is these are negotiations. We've got to talk to allied fields and students and business and parents and scholars and funders and practitioners and government. We have to have a conversation about what is our role. Right now, there are two parallel conversations going on about public libraries. Right? We have a conversation where librarianship is evolving. We're having discussions amongst ourselves about All right, Dave says we need to be more conversation-centric, and, oh, well, we need more, you know, we need more common space, we need more computers, public access computing is important to what we do. We're evolving what it means to be a library. And we're not always involving our community, so every so often our communities walk in our door and go, where are the books? Because we had that conversation without them. And meanwhile, they're having a conversation without us, which is they're cutting our budgets, and we don't appreciate it. But they're having a conversation where they've had a decision of what is the value of a library. We're having a value of a library, and we haven't necessarily done a good job of joining these conversations together to come to an agreement. The other thing is that over time, they will evolve, and sometimes they need to get thrown out. Sometimes we need to renegotiate this charter. My final message. This is Andrew Carnegie, the great patron saint of libraries. And this is one of my favorite quotes from him. Take away my people, but leave me my factories, and soon grass will grow on the factory floors. Take away my factories, but leave my people, and soon we will have a new and better factory. When you look at your libraries, your institutions, when you look at the colleagues and communities, ask yourself, what happens if people took away the facades? What happens if people took away the collections? What happens if people take away the materials? Are we still librarians? I would say yes, and I would say that, in fact, we're more valuable than ever, that we need to look at this, that we are those people, the people who, shoulder by shoulder with our communities, strive to make those communities better. We are the hands of the people shaping that community's future, lifting the people's aspirations and possibilities. We are the sinew and blood of the community, vital to life, strong and ever-present. Together, with the community, of the community, inseparable, we must show those who set budgets and priorities that a cut to the work of librarians is a slash to the community they seek to represent. Our messengers should not be us. Our messengers must be parents and the businessman, the wealthy and the poor, the young and the old, the connected and the disenfranchised. It is they, our brothers and sisters in our community, that must go before decision makers, strip off their sleeves, and show the wounds of cuts and the scars of reductions. Don't rally on the steps among librarians because it looks like self-preservation. We need to have every community member march on those steps going, we elected you to protect the community, and that's us. When we build a library building, we build aspirational institutions. We build what is the best of the community. And what have we chosen? We've chosen libraries. We have chosen knowledge. We have chosen learning. We have chosen you to represent the best of us. They need to stand up and defend us. Mobilizing and being action is only going to happen when we get them mobilized and engaged, and that is only going to happen when we serve them well. When we say, look, here are the books, they're only here because we can help put those together. We are the major asset here. We need to show that every day. That's our challenge. And if we can do that, if we can shape ourselves not to be stewards of a collection, not to be for the community in a separate institution, but of the community and the best of the community and essential to the community and part of that, then our best days are ahead of us. Thank you very much.